all. I'm K2 Romeo, and here with me. My name is Dick, and this is the TechNet. This is TechNet number 1511 of the series that began in September 1982. This particular network gathers the people who have curiosity about how wireless products work. They want to know more about radio. Nobody knows enough about it. No one's ever seen one of those radio waves. We've got a good feel as to what they look like, what they feel like, how they work. And you listen to these various people discussing their impression of their experience, what they've discovered, what works and what doesn't work. You slowly get the story. It's a complicated story. There are 26 different kinds of ham radio. 2-meter FM ham radio, which you're listening to right now, is just one of them. Before you give up this extremely educational hobby, make sure you try one of the other 25. The TechNet has a particular menu we slowly worked out, which consists of people signing in if they have a question or a comment. They give me their call letters, their name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. You need not sign in simply because you're listening. After 31 years of the TechNet, we believe somebody is listening by now. There are four guys that run this TechNet. K2LAW, Dick, John, KC2WGB, Paul, WS2N. John gives us the mailbag and monitors the echo link. Paul tells us what NASA is about to do. We also have Hal, K6DPZ, who gives us a more brief answer in contrast to my long meandering answers. And we don't even ask the question anymore. Does somebody want the brief answer or the long answer? Sometimes one of each is the best to have, if you know what I mean. This TechNet is going to be a little bit different in that, let me drop. Because next weekend, by this time, you will have completed the field day. And field day is the high holy day of ham radio, where many people think that is the most fun thing ham radio operators do, legally, without being married. It's the real gathering of the crew under emergency conditions. You're going to be hearing a report tonight as to what to expect with Limark's field day. We're going to have a report as to what services they need, how you could join, how you can have fun. We're also going to have Bernie K2YO tell us about the new mesh installation. So what I intend to do is to have people sign in, but before we answer their questions, we're going to take those two reports, if they're ready at this time, if not a little bit later, if you know what I mean. Let me drop. So, let me find out who does have a question or a comment. Give me your call letters and name right now, because I'm so darn forgetful. And because you do have a question or a comment, give me your call letters right now. K2LAW, TechNet, Limark, we're listening.
Number two is Zulu Echo Alpha. Yes.
For the field day.
And to XGN, Octopole.
I heard blank 2 ZEO Glenn, and some doubles after that. First of all, Glenn, give me your prefix to blank 2 ZEO.
It's November 2 Zulu Echo Alpha.
Okay, we got November 2. Wes, we got your call letters. Who else signed in after Glenn?
OS, NOI, and I have a field day announcement.
Okay, we heard Neil. Neil, your audio is quite low, but you have a beautiful, strong signal. We have another person who, second time, told us he has a field day announcement, but his call letters got...
That was Matt.
Hey, Matt. And Matt, tell me your call letters.
Kilo Charlie 2, Yankee Delta Tango.
Okay, Charlie 2, Yankee Delta Tango, we got you, Matt, with a field day announcement. Anyone else to sign in, particularly with field day announcements, or just give me their call letters and names, or if they do have a question or comment, give me your call letters and name right now.
KC2MHG.
And Mr. MHG, your name is?
Mario.
Okay, we've got Mario. Anyone else to sign in? If they do have a question or a comment or a field day announcement, give me your call letters and name right now.
Whiskey 2, Bravo Mike Papa, Joe, with an educational announcement, please.
Okay. We're going to take them in the order of field day announcement, educational announcement, and if Bernie's ready for the Matt hookup announcement. So, Matt, go first with your field day announcement. KC2, Yankee Delta Tango, K2LAW. You got it, Matt.
W2RAY, Joe. Checking in.
Okay, thanks again, Dick.
We got you, Joe.
As some of you may know, I am a official relay station for the New York City Long Island section. On field day on Saturday, the Nassau County VHF traffic net is going to try something a little different. We are going to come on our regular repeater, which is 146805 negative SIP PL 1365. Let me let it drop. And then we ask all field day groups that are participating to come on the air at 19:30 hours at 7:30 local and give a radiogram to W2KFV with operators that you currently have additional 100 points to a simplex frequency. We're going to send another radiogram, and then followed by that, we're going to move to NDEMS after that on 145-690-2KL, and we're going to send another radiogram. I'm going to drop. So all in all, your club should be able to get an additional 120 points. Anyone that needs bills or would like information on that, please contact me at my call, Kilo Charlie 2, Yankee Delta Tango, at ARRL.net, and I'll be happy.
Does anybody have any further questions for Matt before we read his portion of the TechNet? Give me a call, let us right now. K2LAW.
Thanks for that.
Thank you. Okay, I heard someone say question or information for Matt. Who was that? It sounds like K.
Alpha Charlie 2, Lima Romeo. For some reason, Matt, I could not hear most of what you said. Your voice kept disappearing. Could you just say your email address again, and I'll email you and ask you for that information, if that's okay? Over to you, Matt.
That was Keith Tango at Alpha Romeo Romeo Lima dot net. My call at the league, ARRL.net.
Got it. Thank you very much. Back to you, Dick.
Very fine, Kay. Anyone else with any further questions or fills needed with Matt's message, give me a call at us right now. K2LAW for TechNet. Okay, the next person who I think had a message, I'm not sure if it was Mario or Joe, I think it was Joe, W2BMP, if that was the person who had a further message about field day, give me a call, give me a message right now, K2LAW.
This is Joe. Can I announce it? Is that okay to proceed now, Dick?
Yes, I think it is, Joe. I think it's okay to proceed now. Go right ahead, Joe.
Okay, thank you. Just a reminder that Great South Bay Amateur Radio Club, located in Babylon, will have a BZ session this Tuesday evening. So if you want to look into take your VE licensing exam to upgrade your license. Tuesday would be a great day. And additionally, just want to let you know that Great South Bay will also be running an in-classroom general class. The general license class. Let me let it drop. If anybody's interested, the class is being held at the Babylon Town Hall. They can contact me and I'll forward you over to Kevin, the head of education for Great South Bay. My call letter, Whiskey 2, Bravo Mike Papa, at limeock.org. Thank you very much.
Very fine, Joe. Anyone have any further questions or comments for Joe's announcement with reference to Limeock, with reference to Field Day and Great South Bay? Give me your call letters right now. K2RIW and the TechNet. Okay, let's see if Bernie is available. K2 Yankee Oscar. Bernie, are you available? K2RIW and the TechNet. And maybe Bernie's going to get and gather us, join us later. He has some further information. Now, one last call. Anyone else with any further information at this time with reference to Field Day, give me your call letters right now. And we'll also do this again in about 45 minutes or so. Anyone else with any further information with reference to Field Day, which will be taking place next weekend at many places along the East Coast, across the whole damn United States. But anybody with any further Field Day information, give me your call letters right now. K2RIW. Okay, that being done, we'll proceed with Glenn's first question. And 2ZEO, K2RIW. Go ahead, Glenn.
The question is, operated out of spec, the answer is a failure mode.
You're going to have to repeat your question now, Glenn. You said something about failure mode. Tell me the rest of the question.
When they're operating.
KE2EJ. K2RIW. Eric, are you available?
WB2OW. What can I do for you, Dick?
Okay. Have you been listening for the last few minutes? And can you make the usual adjustments that Eric would make in that situation? Go ahead, Bob.
Yeah, I'm working on it. We've got two different signals. One is fixed at about half scale. To me, a little weaker than you. That gives you an indication. And the other one apparently is moving at an S 2-3.
Okay, I thank you, Bob, and glad you're working on it. And to ZDO, Glenn, tell us your question one more time. K2RIW. Glenn, don't give up, because things will be changing during the next few minutes. We're going to come back to you, Glenn. Neil, KD2, Charlie Mike, Quebec. Go ahead with your question, Neil. K2RIW and the TechNet.
WGB with a Field Day announcement.
What up, Pitchapapolo? John's field day announcement right now. KC2WGB. KC2 Roger, be good here, John.
Okay, we have an announcement from Livingston, New Jersey. WA2SDF. Dan Victor Mary is having a field day. He'll be operating 2A Livingston, and the information is posted on the ARRL website.
Okay, I forgot to mention that what John does for the last couple of weeks is he monitors the Echo Link so that if people have trouble signing in by way of Echo Link, John knows about it because he's monitoring that email address, and you can also send him messages. And so the WA2SVM message about their two-way operation in Livingston, New Jersey, is what we just heard about. Is there anything else you want to tell us, John? KC2WGB, KC2LAW.
That's it for now, Dick. Let's go through the rest of the field day announcements, if there are any left. I know Bernie still has to make it, so back to you, Dick. KC2WGB.
Very fine, John. Let's see if Bernie is available this time. K2 Yankee Oscar. K2 RAW the Tech Man. Okay, maybe he is not. Do you want to make another attempt right now, Glenn? N2 Zebra Echo Oscar. Go ahead with your question, Glenn. K2 RAW the Tech Man.
Okay, thank you, Dick. My question is about a vacuum tube and how it ages and eventually how it enters into failure mode. And when it's operated out of spec, what happens as it enters the failure mode that way too? I'm going to call November 2 Zulu Echo Alpha.
Sorry about that, Glenn. Zulu Echo Alpha. And I've been hearing Zulu Echo Oscar all this time. Alrighty. I'll give you some opinions from my point of view on vacuum tubes. The man who has used vacuum tubes even longer than I have is Hal, K6DPZ. He's available. Let's start off with the concise answer first, Hal. K6DPZ, K2RIW, the Tech Man.
W detect on K6DPZ. Okay, Dick. Now, what questions does he want to basically know about vacuum tubes? Because it's a very broad bit of information. So if you can tell me what he wants to know, maybe I can give him some fast suggestions. So, go ahead. This is K6DPZ.
Yeah, what Neil specifically, what Glenn specifically asks is that as a vacuum tube ages, what is the usual mechanism of failure? And with reference to failure, are there things that an amateur can do by mistake that would aggravate that failure and give premature aging of the tube? Are there things that a ham radio operator can do if he wants to treat his vacuum tube with tender loving care and get the maximum life out of it? So, failure mechanisms, mistakes that we make, good things that we can do to make your vacuum tube happy, strong, and live long. K6DPZ, K2RIW, the Tech Man.
First, if we're talking about retracting tubes, and receiving tubes, the main thing is running the tubes circuitry that are within the spec. That's most important. With transmitting tubes, it's very critical to maintain a proper filament voltage on the transmitting tubes. Higher filament voltage causes more emission. Dad, some of the other things you're going to approach on is in testing tubes, if you have a piece of radio equipment, a receiver or a transmitter, and you're not sure, they say you want to replace all the tubes in it, what I would suggest is you get these tube kits is take a tube, put it in a piece of equipment. If the amount of signal or sensitivity or power is better, keep it in. If it's the same, do not use the new tube. And that goes through your transmitting tubes, low power tubes, or anything. The other thing is in transmitting tubes, many times you can check a transmitting tube, especially if you're working with a linear amplifier or something like that. Look at the idling current. And if you have a tube with a given idling current, a transmitting tube, oh, like a 3500C, 6146, 811, and you turn around and plug another tube in, and if the idling current is less, the emission of the tube is less. If the idling current is higher, it's a hotter tube. Those are the basic things. Just treat tubes that way. They're glass, and don't lay transmitting tubes, directly heated tubes, on their side, because the filament can tend to warp and hit the grid. But if indirectly heated tube, there's no problem. There's a cathode. But the directly heated tube, like an 811, a 4400, that mainly has filament, no cathode. You only want to keep it vertical.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Wait. That's the basics. I hope I've been some help to you. This is Cape.
Yeah, thank you, Hal. That's a darn good beginning. I have often operated my transmitter on its side, very similar to what people will do with a tower repeater. Put it on its side or on its flat bottom, and whatever. And it's a brand new factor to me that an indirectly heated tube that's not operated in the vertical mode can warp that filament and create some extra grease. When it comes to the filament voltage, each tube has an extremely accurate amount of filament voltage that the manufacturer recommends, and you shouldn't go below that or above that. Above that, of course, you're artificially aging the filament. You could be overheating it. There is some very exotic chemistry that's in a well-operated cathode, and if you boil that exotic chemistry to the surface too rapidly by running the filament voltage too high, that will artificially age the tube. If you run the filament voltage too low, there are also some nasty effects that can happen with the tube. When it comes to the plate dissipation, and I'm not talking now about primarily transmitting tubes, because these are the ones that we worry about the most. They're expensive. They're the ones that we can easily mistreat. Let me drop. In the case of a transmitting tube, there's a certain amount of plate dissipation you're not supposed to exceed. When you first turn on the transmitter, you first press down the key, and if you're looking for full power output, and if it's a manual tune type transmitter where you've got a tuning control and a loading control, a real Pi output network, a slightly older rig. And if you operate it for, let me pick a number, more than 10 seconds while it is detuned, if you're very slow in doing the tuning procedure and the tank circuit is running out of resonance, you could be putting a kilowatt of power into the tube because you've got it mistuned. Only 100 watts is coming out, and for the full tube is dissipating 900 watts, if you know what I mean. For a few seconds, it can take that. You do it for 30 seconds, keyed down, mistuned. There's a good chance the tube anode, if you're looking at it, it starts glowing red, and you can melt things down, and again, you can do artificial aging. What some people will do in that situation is run an automatic keyer where you're just transmitting dots so that the duty factor is low while you're doing the tuning procedure just to be super safe. And on some rigs, there is the so-called tune procedure, where it's running at a slightly lower power output while you're doing the tuning again to protect the tube. So try to protect it from over-dissipation. Al told us about filament voltage. Be careful about that and make sure it's in the vertical mode. When you do all of these things just right, under normal circumstances, let me drop. That transmitting tube should give you maximum life. And do, of course, check that so-called standby current. In other words, when you key the transmitter into the transmit mode, it's a final amplifier, we'll say, an afterburner, but you're not driving it, no real signal is going in. There's a so-called bias setting. In other words, there's a certain voltage put onto the control grid where the tube can draw a certain amount of given well-defined current. It might be 100 milliamps of plate current. And so, in some cases, there is an adjustment control where you can increase or decrease that cathode depression, the control grid voltage, that the standby current is either above or below that number. When you're using the transmitter recommended procedure for that standby current, usually you'll get maximum sideband linearity. You'll get the sweetest sounding signal coming out of the tube, and you're using it in the way the manufacturer intended. So I'm adding a couple of other experiences of mine along those lines. If all goes well, a tube should last you tremendous amounts of time. The particular 4CX250B tube that I put into my parallel kilowatt transmitter in 1972 Two of those tubes, here I am today, they are still in good operation, still giving me about 90% of the power output. You properly treat tubes, and sometimes it will last a long time. Once in a blue moon, let me drop it. Once in the blue moon, something can go wrong where the tube starts becoming gassy. Some extra air gets in from the outside. And then you will start getting some peculiar characteristics. And if you have another tube and you can do the substitution test, you'll see a significant difference in power output, standby current. Some of the meter readings will be kind of crazy when you get a tube with air leaking into it, a so-called gassy tube. Don't lose a lot of sleep over that. That's a fairly rare condition, but it does occasionally happen. I wonder if you want to add anything to all of the above, Hal. K6DPZ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
IW the TechNet, K6DPZ. The only thing I really wanted to add, beware buying sweep tubes on the internet. The reason being, a sweep tube, when you get it, could look perfect, but yet it could be because they have a very thin plate. So many people use sweep tubes and flatten them and then try to dump them on the internet. That's the only comment I have. If you're going to buy sweep tubes, buy them from a reliable source, not from some everyone on the internet. Dick, go ahead.
Tweel, may I make a useful comment, Dick?
No.
Now, for those who have not been around for as long as Hal and I and John, the word sweep tube may be a brand new set of words to you. Back in the old days where we were using vacuum tubes for our television set, the horizontal output tube, so-called horizontal sweep, so that's how they got that name, is a specific class of tubes, very high power output tubes by television standards, were used for those sweep tubes, and many guys found ways of using those tubes into a high power transmitter. And so the good news is that there's a lot of them, they were not very expensive, and they gave you a lot of bang for the money. The bad news that you were hearing from Hal is that some of those tubes that are called sweep tubes and transmitters that are designed for them, the older transmitters, you gotta be a little bit careful as to where you get them from. Many guys nowadays are buying what used to be extremely expensive transmitting tubes, great big bottles, from a Russian company called Svetlana. And I think Svetlana has an extremely good reputation from everything I'm hearing from my VHF, UHF operators. I wonder if you have any opinions about Svetlana as a source of tubes, of these high-power transmitting tubes, Hal. Wonder if you've heard any good or bad news along those lines. K6DPZ, K2LIW on the TechNet.
Svetlana is not too bad, but so RF Parts is selling tubes, and they market them under Taylor, and those tubes aren't bad either. The meaning is buy your tubes from somebody who's reputable. Just buying them as bargains on the internet, you really get financially hurt because you don't have very much recourse. You tell somebody you buy it on the internet, it's not working right, they'll tell you to flatten them. Comment, Dick.
So as you can tell, Glenn, many of us have got quite a bit of experience, both positive and negative. We've learned some of the things that you should do and shouldn't do. And there's a lot more to the story, but I think we've given you a thumbnail sketch of the beginning of it. You're allowed to come back and ask this question as many times as you want, as many weeks in a row as you want, until you finally get a warm and fuzzy feeling about the proper treating of your particular very valuable glowing fermionic emission device called vacuum tube, the final stage of many transmitters. Hal and I and John are pretty strong enthusiasts of tube finals. We're also, in some cases, at least I am, pretty strong enthusiast about a manually tuned transmitter because they have an extremely large impedance matching range. Your antenna might have a 3-to-1 standing wave ratio. With a manually tuned transmitter, no sweat. With some of these brand new no-tuned transmitters, what they've really done is taking out that manual tuning operation and taking it away from you and told you that you've now got to keep the antenna under a 1.5 standing wave ratio. And yes, it looks like it's more convenient and more compact transmitter. And then that Pi-King tuning network that used to be there with the tuning and loading control, now they sell that back to you as the so-called antenna tuning network, which is what you really needed in the first place in many situations, in my opinion. Not everyone's going to agree with that. So you probably have some other questions on what you've heard so far, Neil. into ZEA. K2LAW, check that. You got it, Glenn.
Julio, Dick.
The tube becoming gassy and the filament chemistry changes. What physically happens inside the tube to make it fail?
If the filament is run too hot or too cold, because you've made the filament voltage too high or too low, step by a second. Many transmitters will have a control you can set in the front panel where you monitor the filament voltage. Or many transmitters will have a variable control sometimes on the back of the transmitter. Sometimes it's a rheostat, sometimes it's a variac, by which you can slowly increase or decrease the filament voltage. If your particular transmitter tube says it should be operating at 5.0 volts, make sure it is that way, measured with a good accurate meter. Some of the many transmitting tubes, you think it would operate on 6.3 volts, one of the most popular voltages, but some of these transmitting tubes are told by the manufacturer to operate 6.0 volts. You operate it at 6.3 instead of 6.0, you're running the cathode hotter than need be. As such, you will artificially age the cathode. In the case of an incandescent light bulb and the filament of a transmitter has some similarity with the filament that's in an incandescent light bulb. As you change the voltage you apply to a filament of an incandescent light bulb, it makes a huge difference in life. It is something like voltage raised to the 10th or 12th power gives you the ratio of life at the new voltage versus the old voltage. Higher voltage is shorter life. So in the case of light bulbs, there's a huge difference in voltage versus life of an incandescent light bulb. The filament of a transmitter has a situation not quite as severe as that, but a little bit like that. So of the ways that we amateurs sometimes abuse tubes, wrong filament voltage, wrong standby current, and over-dissipating the cathode because of operating long periods of time, but the final stage not properly tuned. When that final stage is properly tuned, you do get the rated power output. If you're getting the rated power output of the tube, measured by your bird wattmeter in the key down mode. Let me drop. You're getting the rated power output. There's a high probability you've got things tuned correctly and working correctly. If you're getting 70% of what should be the rated power output, you've either got a tube that's soft, that really means low on emission, artificially aged, at the end of life, slightly gassy, or whatever, and then it's time to start doing some investigation, in my opinion. Not everyone's going to agree with this, but if you're starting to get 70% of what you think the power output should be, your transmitter is supposed to be giving you 100 watts output, key down, on the 20-meter band, and you're only getting 70 watts output. In my opinion, it's a good idea to start an investigation. Do I have the right filament voltage? Is my power supply giving the right plate voltage? Is the standby current right before I drive it? When I do drive it, is it drawing the rated current? And if there are manual tuning controls, is the tuning network giving you a dip in current output showing you are hitting resonance? Is the loading control running within range? If your loading control hits maximum clockwise or maximum counterclockwise, usually suggesting that the antenna has a higher viswas than the transmitter can tolerate, that's something to start investigating. So these are some of the things I would look for, if you know what I mean, Neil. Glenn. Wonder if that makes some sense, Glenn. And 2ZEA, K2LIW in the deck net.
Hey, got it. You're at 2 weeks.
Glenn, do you have any further questions on that? Or do you think that'll do for now? You got it, Glenn.
Maybe I'll catch you field day. You going next week?
Yes, I intend to be there. However, I can't tell you for sure which hour at which place. I visit three of my favorite field day sites, which is the Rockfield site for Huntington, the Limart site, and usually one other site. So I can't promise you for sure what hour I will be at which one, but I do intend to visit at least three of them, Glenn. N2ZEA, K2LIW.
Okay, sounds like fun. We'll catch you next week. 73, thank you for the information. Appreciate it. N2ZEA, for awesome.
Okay, Neil, Kilo Delta 2, Charlie Mike, Quebec. VK2LAW. Go right ahead, Neil.
Yes, Dick. I wanted to ask about the effect of aluminum siding on a house on a wire antenna run down the eaves of a house parallel to it. In other words, I have a friend who has a G5R running down the eaves of his house, and 15 feet away is the next house, and that house is aluminum siding, and he feels that his antenna just isn't putting out as it should. Now, there are a lot of other possibilities that could cause the problem, but one of the big questions is, what effect, if any, is the aluminum siding on the house 15 feet away from the antenna having? I know it's not coupling, but I'm not sure if it's going to be completely invisible to the transmission either. Over.
Before I answer that question, Neil, one other quick question. Is he using that antenna on any 40, 20? Which band is he using it on? You'll soon see why I'm asking that. Go right ahead, Neil.
I'm not sure. He basically plays around on 20, 40, and 80. And he might go to other bands at different times. Over.
Okay. I'm going to warn you ahead of time, Neil. You're going to get very mixed opinions on this exact subject. So people are going to tell you that the aluminum siding is terrible and you've got to keep the antenna very far away. I am not one of those. And there's a set of reasons why I believe that I'm going to give it to you right now. I'm glad you did say 80 meters because it's my favorite band to make this particular point. Every antenna has a radio area, a sector of the capture area. We usually talk about that in the receiving mode. But because of the law of reciprocity of antennas, that's a fancy way of saying whatever you measure in gain, beam width, bandwidth, front-to-back ratio, all the parameters, standing wave ratio, all the parameters you measure for an antenna in the transmitting mode, every reasonable, normal antenna will have the exact same performance on every one of those parameters when you now switch over and go to the receive mode. So receive versus transmit, doesn't matter. An antenna is an antenna is an antenna. However, every antenna has this capture area. Every microphone has a capture area. Every loudspeaker has a capture area. If you're talking about audio. You plug in the numbers. The area of an antenna is 2d squared of a lambda. In other words, you take one minute. That's near field range. Sorry about that. Antenna area is gain lambda squared over 4 pi. If you really know the gain of an antenna, in the case of a dipole-like antenna, the gain really is something like 2.14 dB as a decibel number. As a hard number, you take the anti-log of that, and it's something like 1.64. So a dipole has a hard number gain of 1.64. That's the gain number. Lambda, you know what 80 meters is, and you square that, and divide it by gain lambda squared over 4 pi. You plug in those numbers for an 80-meter dipole. Let me drop. An 80-meter dipole has an effective capture area of 8,500 square feet. I'm not kidding. If your eyes operated at 80 meters and you stood away a quarter of a mile and you looked at your antenna, you would see a great big black oval in space around that antenna. That oval would be 50% wider than the antenna, and it would be probably 150 feet wide and something like 50 feet high would be this black oval in space. Any horizontally polarized 80-meter signal approaching that antenna side, broadside, all of that 8,500 square feet would be sucked up by the antenna. It would go down the feed line and it would start moving the signal strength meter on the receiver, if you know what I mean. The reason that's important, the reason why amateurs don't know this, because they don't calculate area. The worst case situation I can think of, where lots of guys will lose a lot of sleep, is they set up their 80-meter dipole north-south because they want to favor people to the east and west. They want to talk to their guy in South Africa, if you know what I mean. Great circle path to the east is where South Africa is, or to the northeast is where your buddy in London is. So you set up the antenna to favor that. But 20 feet in front of the antenna is a Con Ed piece of wiring or a LIPA piece of wiring that's at the exact same altitude directly in front of your antenna. And you would think, boy, it's going to block the signal in that direction. As long as that wire of Con Ed or LIPA is not resonant, then it casts a shadow of a couple of square feet onto your antenna. And your antenna has a capture area of 8,500 square feet. And by the way, the sun's shining down on your 80-meter dipole. Let me drop. The sun shining down on your dipole casts a shadow on the ground of around 1 square foot of all of that 132 feet of wire, your 14-gauge wire that you made it out of. So as you can see, what your eye sees, 1 square foot of shadow, versus the radio area, because the antenna is resonant, 8,500 square feet. Now you start thinking about how much area is the aluminum siding of the house, and is it hitting resonance? The chances of the aluminum siding hitting resonance at 80, 40, or 20 meters is very rare, very unlikely. And now, how much blockage is it covering? And is that blockage in the direction of where your signal is coming from? So you can see that from my philosophy, from my point of view, I think 98% of the time, the siding is not there. Now, I will admit, there's a slim possibility that those pieces of aluminum siding are rubbing against each other, making a scratchy contact. On a windy day, you might get some static from that. And by the same token, the conduit wiring across the street, it has an arcing insulator or an arcing transformer. Yes, you can get a lot of QR Nancy or QR Mary. You get a lot of static from that. And maybe you have to make a call to LIPA to have them fix that arcing insulator. But for just sitting there as a passive shadow-making device, it's very unlikely. Now, he may not be happy with his antenna because it's not the right one exactly. His dipole-like antenna, his G5 RV, might not be the right number of feet across off the ground, which means it's acting like a near-vertical incident skywave, NVIS, Nevis antenna, and squirting the signal straight up because he doesn't have it high enough up. And maybe in the direction of the guys he wants to talk to, there's a great big hill in the way, so to speak. Or he's doing it when the ionosphere is not favoring him. And there's other funny things that can happen. Your horizontally polarized antenna, sending that signal to your buddy in London. One of the other things that's very rarely talked about is the signal is going to be going through the ionosphere one or two bounces in order to get over there in London. The ionosphere is a plasma. A plasma, which really means the fourth state of matter. It's got some free electrons and free nucleuses, you know what I mean? The sun shining on the ionosphere has separated those with ultraviolet rays, and that plasma mixed with the Earth's magnetic field does create this crazy characteristic called Faraday rotation. So that signal you launch that's horizontally polarized goes through the ionosphere, gets twisted a couple of times, and might arrive vertical at your buddy in London. Your buddy in London is using a vertical antenna, and he's very happy. And he transmits a vertical signal back to you. Common sense would lead you to believe you're going to reverse the process and get a horizontal signal coming back to Long Island. That's not the way Faraday rotation obeys. That's the one thing that we know about that violates reciprocity. You may get three twists clockwise on the signal going from New York to London. You may get two twists counterclockwise, and the signal's going from London back to New York. So therefore, the signal that launched at London vertical may end up vertical in New York, even though the horizontal signal from New York arrives vertical in London. You can see why you hear a real strong signal from your buddy in London. You assume he's going to hear you like gangbusters, and you talk to him, and he says, boy, you're over weak. Now you're seeing some of the crazy details. It's very...
Repeater, time out.
It's very easy to start looking for reasons and start blaming it on the aluminum siding. I wouldn't say it's impossible, but I think it's unlikely. Now, I'll warn you that you now know the reasons I've got those opinions, and if I say those words on the 20-meter band today, a fair number of people will jump down my throat and say, you're absolutely crazy, that's not what I've experienced. So, probably some further investigation is required to get to the bottom of it, but now you know how I feel in this one, Neil. KD2, Charlie Mike, Quebec, KTRIW in the TechNet.
Yes,
Dick,
my real concern was, would the signal scatter off the aluminum siding, and since it's so close to the antenna, and signals are going to go in a straight line and perform that donut, would it be creating a major shadow in the radiation pattern, I guess would be the right term. The big question is, will the aluminum siding, what effect will the aluminum siding have on the signal? Will it bounce off it? will it be invisible to it? I know it's not, you know, I understand that something has to be resonant to absorb the signal or cover with it, but the big question was, will it bounce off the aluminum siding or will it go right through? Over.
I say it would go right through the aluminum siding like it's not there. If I had asked you the question, what is your guess as to the amount of area of the aluminum siding compared to the area of the dipole at 80 meters? 8,500 square feet. That is a chunk of space, of a black hole in space, that's an elliptical-shaped hole, that's what the antenna is sucking up radio-wise. That's 150 feet wide and 60 feet high as the major axis and the minor axis of that ellipse. What do you believe is the percentage of area of that aluminum siding compared to that picture I've just drawn to you? And if the area of the aluminum siding was in the wrong direction and it had 8,500 square feet, it would probably give you a couple of decibels of insertion loss. But the aluminum siding is not in that direction. It can't give any significant amount of reflecting area because it is so damn much smaller than the area of that dipole, even though your eye doesn't see it. It's starting to get an impression of why I think the aluminum siding is really a red herring in this situation, Neil. KD2 Charlie Mike Quebec, K2LIW the TechNet.
Okay, Dick. If the aluminum siding is not going to scatter the signal completely, if it's going to be fairly invisible to the signal, then I understand exactly what you're saying. And I guess that's the answer. He actually wanted to replace the G5R with another wire antenna, and my concern was that just placing another antenna in that position would not help him at all. But we have some more investigation to do into why his performance is so bad. But thank you for eliminating that. KD2CMQF.
So you have an interesting situation there, Neil. And you and your buddy are going to do some further investigation. By way of a bird watt meter, you can make sure that the antenna is giving you reasonable standing wave ratio. What's the forward power to reverse power ratio on a bird watt meter, for instance? And there's many other ways of measuring standing wave ratio. If he's using a good antenna tuner and a low loss feed line, even that could be a red herring. Many, many amateurs don't realize what resources they have. So somewhere on his property, there may be a higher tree. By way of a slingshot mechanism, he can now send a sinker up there and pull down a piece of monofilament line and eventually mount his antenna higher than it is right now. Anything you can do to increase the altitude of the antenna, the desirable direction of the antenna, that's going to help. If the antenna is hanging over the eaves of the house and it's very closely coupled to the wiring of the house, giving you television interference and telephone interference, that's not desirable. But I guarantee there are ways we can mount that antenna in a better location and maybe change the antenna. And we amateurs, we see wire. Our neighbors do not see wire. Let me drop. So if you're an enthusiastic amateur, you've got one chunk of wire that favors north-south, another chunk of wire up there that favors east-west, another chunk of wire that's high, another chunk of wire that's low, separate feed lines going to those. You switch between them at various times when you're talking to people in various directions at various distances. No matter how many antennas you've got right now, Neil, it ain't enough. Wire is not very expensive. The neighbors don't see the wire. Only hams see it. Always string more antennas. Always do more antenna experiments. We don't build many of our 80 to 10 meter transmitters anymore. We take a week's worth of salary, we buy it from Southeast Asia, and we get our money's worth. Because if you try to homebrew it, it would take you a year of your life to do it. But we do a lot of experimenting with antennas. There's no end to that. That's the fun part of it. Keep doing it, and let us know what you find. And please come back and tell us what you find, Neil. Next guy who signed in was Mario, Kilo Charlie 2, Mike Hotel Golf. You're right ahead, Mario. K2LAW to check that. Okay, I don't hear Mario there right now. One of the next people who signed in was Joe, W2RYY. W2RYY, sorry to keep you waiting, Joe, because I know you got to get up early in the morning. K2RYW and check that. You got it, Joe. One more call. W2RYY. Are you there? K2LIW. Okay, let's see if we've got Bernie yet. K2 Yankee Oscar. Are you available, Bernie? K2LIW. Boy, I'm batting 1,000 tonight. Hello, anybody? Okay. Before we proceed, anybody with any further information they'd like to tell us or questions they've got with reference to the high holy days of ham radio, field day, next weekend, be there or be square. Anybody got any further questions or comments, give me a call letters right now, K2RIW.
Yeah, enter GN, it's related to field later, WJQB Whiskey, Juliet 2 Bravo, Joe.
Very fine, Joe, WJ2B. Tell us anything you want about field day and take your time. You got it, Joe.
It's a little related to field day, but I have a question for you, Dick. I guess everybody knows that Weimark's field day is set up Saturday morning and take down Sunday afternoon and all that. Everybody knows about that stuff, so we don't have to repeat that. But I have a sort of an antenna-related question about trees and foliage and trees, especially when they have the leaves in the summer. How does that affect the radiation pattern or as far as blocking antennas in certain directions? If you have a tree, let's say, that has a branch with a lot of leaves on, let's say a big oak tree, and it's hanging within, let's say, less than a wavelength away from the radiating elements of the antenna. And I definitely noticed I have a very large tree near my VHF, UHF, and I noticed a slight difference from when it has leaves and when it doesn't as far as how I pick up the repeaters based on the S-meter readings. I just wonder if I am imagining things or I guess UHF it probably will affect more because depending on the size of the leaves and that. I'm just curious if you ever did any studies or anybody ever did a study on that, how leaves and trees affect how RF propagates, especially if it's close and within the near field pattern of the antenna there. That could be the WJ today.
It's a good question, Joe, and I have done a bit of research on that one. When I first got on the 432 band, oh, this is way back in the dark ages of 1969. In those days, you were really on the radio frontier. That was a super high frequency. And I had taken my 432 to 7 megacycle converter into my receiver, brought home my Hewlett Packard 608 signal generator from Airborne Instruments Laboratory, and calibrated my S-meter. So therefore, I could tell everybody on 432 that I talked to how many microvolts of signal they're giving me today. And so, I had these 450 cards in a card file of all the guys I talked to on 432. And half of those guys would say, hey, Dick, how many microvolts am I giving to you today when I transmit? I've made this change to my antenna. I went from a Yagi to a square loop antenna. I raised the antenna another 10 feet. And we compared the signal strength summer, winter, spring, and fall. And here's what I discovered. On the 432 band, the guys who had antennas that didn't clear the trees, the trees were 80 foot high on that property, and the antennas mounted 40 feet above the ground. In the wintertime, those guys sounded good. In the summertime, with the leaves on the trees and water on those leaves, the signal was 15 to 20 decibels weaker because of the foliage on those trees, particularly when it was wet with water. So 15 to 20 dB of difference, summer versus winter. Because of foliage on 432, when the antenna didn't clear the trees. When the antenna was mounted on the high enough tower so it did clear the trees, the difference was negligible. So on 432, huge difference if you've got to transmit through trees. 2 meters, not quite as severe, but there's a similar situation. Go all the way down to 80 meters. 80 meters now with a wavelength of 260 feet, roughly. Can we drop 60? And all the dimensions of your tree, the big branches, the tall mast on it, the leaves, and everything else. Right. In general, all of those dimensions are very small compared to any of the components of the tree. Therefore, at 80 meters, that tree is, I'm going to pick a number, 95% transparent. The signal flows right through it. Also, you can get a similar situation when you study the American National Standard Institute report, the C5 report on radio frequency biohazard. You discover that an 80-meter frequency, 3.5 megahertz, goes through a human being, doesn't stop, doesn't give any heating. The human being is almost not there. So a human being is fairly transparent to 80 meters, so is a tree. You get to 30 to 300 megacycles, the human being starts absorbing a high percentage of the radio VHF signal that hits them. It gets absorbed into the human being, turned into heat. And now whether or not it's dangerous is a function of can that portion of the human being tolerate the heat. And the eyes are a portion that can't tolerate very heat, very much heat. So you've got to be kind of careful about that. So the absorption of a human, the absorption of a tree, there's a strong similarity of absorption versus frequency. You can look at that graph in the ANSI report and look at that bathtub-shaped curve, where at low frequencies, the amount of maximum permitted exposure is a great big number because the signal can flow right through you. So at high frequencies, above 1,500 megacycles, the signal reflects off a human being, doesn't even penetrate. Can we drop? So pound for pound, the frequencies above 1,500 megacycles, the so-called microwave frequencies, are 5 to 1 safer than VHF frequency. Of course, that sounds opposite of common sense. So, in the case of a human being, microwave frequencies reflect off. Well, that reflection, that microwave frequency, because of the tree is in front of you, that's not good. The guy on the other side of that, as far as the trees, is not going to hear you very well. So, there's a sliding scale of how much grief you get from trees versus frequency. Low frequencies, the trees are almost not there. Yes, a great big branch of a tree with a bunch of leaves on it near the tip of your dipole is going to add some capacitance to the extra tip of the dipole, extra capacitance. That's going to give you some change in the tuning of the dipole, and with an antenna tuning, you can accommodate that. And you could, if you wanted to be a purist, you could slightly change the length of the dipole in the summertime by taking off the clip leads you put on the end. And in the wintertime, you put the clip lead back on if you want the dipole to be 100% resonant every part of the year. You could do that, and it's not as crazy as it sounds. So you can see my feeling on this one. Oh, boy. My goodness. So, you can see my feeling on this one. There's a lot of people who lose a lot of sleep about trees, and on HF frequencies, a heck of a percentage, a significant percentage of the time, they really shouldn't be losing sleep over it, in my opinion, Joe. But once again, if you have the resources to mount the antenna higher, please do it. It's almost always going to give you a benefit. WJ2B, K2LIW, and the TechNet. You got it, Joe.
Okay, Dick, very good. That's about what I theorized. I said probably very little below 30, a little bit on 6 meters, you know, negligible, probably a little bit worse on 2 meters from what I've noticed, maybe a few dBs of difference between summer and winter. And like you said, 432, I really don't have that many repeaters that I, probably only the 449, 125 that I can get a good signal on over here. But, yeah, definitely notice it on 449, 125, that signal drops a little bit in the summer. So definitely, like you said, the trees do have an effect, especially if your antenna is lower than the trees, which is pretty hard. The amount of trees in Suffolk County here, usually, like you said, 70, a lot of the trees are 70 to 80 feet high. So it's pretty hard to get your antenna above those trees unless you have a very expensive tower set up. To try to put something on your house that's 80 feet high, I don't think the house can support that too easily. But the other thing another thing I want to mention was, I remember I asked Eric KE2EJ once about a problem I was having at my mom's house in Valley Stream about her TV reception with the new digital TV signals, and those are all up in UHF, you know, higher than 400 megahertz, and she was noticing she was getting interference on the signal when it was raining, and she has a tree right behind the antenna, like in between the antenna and the city where the signal's coming from, and he said, yeah, definitely wet leaves will affect it, cause multi-path interference, so that's another problem with the TV signals, with the rain and the leaves and all that.